Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare and science being the main topics, but also a little sprinkling of public policy, and as always, answers to your questions and emails and calls. So, before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. And furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So I thought I would start out this week with something a little bit different, a film review, if you will. This was a special request from one of our listeners who is wanting to tell us all about a film that will be debuting at the Del Mar Theater November 17th, at least it's Santa Cruz debut. And this is a sponsored project by the Save Our Shores and your local blue ocean community. So this is kind of an interesting movie called Bag It, and it's more about plastics, taking it from the standpoint a little bit of a single guy in the street exploring plastics and, you know, a little bit of a, assuming the role of a naive person. By the way, Ivian, spelled backwards, is naive, which is wonderful when you think in terms of the concept of selling people bottled water. And indeed, bottled water and bottled beverages are one of the chief focuses of this movie. And another aspect of it is the concept of how much has actually been promoted by the plastics lobby and the ubiquitous plastic bag, which is the central piece of Bag It, trying to persuade people to do otherwise, carrying their own bags, and the naive first-person narrator and chief actor in this film does go out and try to avoid containers. That means sometimes trying to get beverages put in his own cup and having difficulty at fast food places where laws against cross-contamination prevent them from putting the hamburger on his own plate. Well, it's an interesting odyssey with a little touch of Michael Moore, and I hope you will attend and enjoy. It's this coming 17th, that's Wednesday, at 7 p.m. at the Del Mar Theater, Bag It. I'd say it's a must-see, and I hope you'll get there. Before we go any further, I thought I would talk a little bit about an interesting plastics-related story. It seemed to resonate well with the film review, and that thanks to Duff, who's one of my regular listeners, for the heads up on this one. Recent article, series of articles actually, published online in a journal called Chemosphere, established that BPA, that bisphosphonyl A, the thing that we have talked about so much because of its properties as an endocrine stimulant, is going to be something we now have to think about every time we get one of those little thermoplastic receipts. And those thermoplastic receipts are in your hands, and you walk from the cash register to a table and eat your pizza or eat your hamburger. Meanwhile, this study has established that you absorb the BPA through the skin of your fingers. And this, there's several studies actually that I want to talk about. The first one used just a lab study where they used human skin from cadavers and also pig skin and measured how much BPA could be absorbed into the skin. This is kind of a science project where it's a science fair project, really. So it doesn't mimic the sorts of conditions in the street. You're not going to sit there, smear monomer BPA on your hand and leave it there for 3 days. But the concept that, yes, it does absorb into skin was established by this study. And further studies done epidemiologically looking at BPA levels in pregnant women and looking at the occupation of the women showed something rather scary, which is that women who worked as cashiers in retail, who would be handling those thermal printed receipts all the time, all day long, as they tore them off and handed them to customers, these cashiers had a level of BPA in their bloodstream that was double that of teachers and industrial workers, except probably for people working in the industrial plastic industry. Nevertheless, this suggests that indeed skin absorption can create a problem occupationally that is getting up to a level, 2.8 micrograms per gram, which is concentrated enough to have measurable effects on offspring. And so pregnant women who are working as cashiers, frequent hand washing, maybe using a barrier cream, although that hasn't been studied. I think I would probably go with one of the barrier creams that are designed to keep your skin from absorbing, or else just wear gloves. Very significant, though, I think, that the blood levels that we're measuring in humans are the blood levels that we see in rats where we see changes in offspring. And indeed, with the phthalate study looking at the blood levels in the umbilical cord of babies and then correlating to, you know, how feminized are the genitals in baby boys. And what they found was a direct correlation between phthalate levels and feminization of the genitals. You know, we can see these effects in infants and in mice and rats at similar blood levels. We really need to accept that we have a pollution issue here, and those thermal receipts are something that we need to change. But in the meantime, wash your hands. Don't handle one of those things and eat, because you're obviously going to absorb more through your mouth than you are through your fingers. And if you can absorb it through your fingers, well, enough said. Just say, no receipt, thank you very much, and walk away. I wanted to take just a moment and mention something. We were talking earlier about BPA, and when they were looking at BPA levels and risk factors in pregnant women, one of the other risk factors they found for elevated BPA was consuming canned vegetables once a day or more. Not, by the way, canned fruits, interestingly enough. And the concept is that the cans are lined with BPA plastic. There are starting to be BPA-free cans. That happened in only a year once people started avoiding canned foods, once word was out about BPA in cans. We can get industry to turn around on this. And what we have to do is say we aren't buying products that contain BPA. In fact, if you can always conscientiously choose the products, if there's a competition, choose the one that has less plastic, that has less packaging. You can make a statement. If you take with you a small box cutter and remove the item from the large plastic clamshell and leave that in the store for them to deal with, if we all started doing that, the store managers would start demanding from their suppliers that the clamshells go away, because it's becoming a problem for the store, who is, by the way, the customer as far as the supplier is concerned. So what we need to do is modify our behavior so that we feed back to industry that we don't like BPA, and in fact, we don't like unnecessary plastic, and we're going to buy the product that doesn't have unnecessary plastic. And you know what? It's evolutionary, folks. It's survival of the fittest out there, and the corporations and the big companies are absolutely tuned in to what we will and will not buy. We can be more proactive in this matter, and I really think we should be. So New Year's resolution early a little bit this year is I'm getting that little box cutter and I am leaving the clamshell where I purchased it. Very ostentatiously, here, you deal with this and we'll see what happens. Hope you'll join me on that. And let's go now to the phones. We're going first to Beulah in Carmel. Hello, Beulah, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for your advice a couple of weeks ago. I called to saying that you can't find out if you had chickenpox as a child in order to decide whether or not to have a shingles shot. And you explained that you can have a titer test, and I did, and I just got my result, and I'm immune. I don't have to have a shingles shot.
Well, actually, you're misinterpreting your results, Beulah.
Oh, I am?
Yes, you are. So let me help you out with that. If you're immune, then what that means is that you had chickenpox. And people who are at risk, it's paradoxical, but stay with me on this. The people who are at risk for zoster are the people who are immune to chickenpox, because the immunity means that you had the infection. If you had the infection, then there's probably virus still in your body, because we know this virus never goes away. It hibernates. It goes into suspended animation. And as you age and your immune system becomes less effective, that's when it reactivates. So, in fact, you would be a candidate.
Oh, bah humbug.
I know, I'm sorry. But the concept...
My doctor just sent the report in and said, this means you are immune.
Right, but meaning that you're immune means paradoxically that that's who's vulnerable.
Yeah, I've interpreted that to mean that I was okay.
No.
Oh, well, thank you again. Glad I called. Thank you.
It is paradoxical, and I'm glad you called too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Dr. Don, I'm looking at a recent blood test, and it looks so great in all the numbers. And I just had to ask you a quick question, and then I had a statement. The score on this blood test indicates that the total cholesterol is 160. Is that good, too low, or average?
That is good. I'd say it's below average, at least the average that I typically clinically see on the cholesterols I check. And it was three questions. It is good. It's not too low, but it's below average. So.
Yeah, okay.
Did I cover them all?
Yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to, again, thank you for all the wonderful information that you put forth. In terms of trying to save the planet, I've been doing my little part for the past 20 years, 12 to 18 hours a day. That's what I do for my retirement.
And what sort of things do you do, Robert?
Salmon stream restoration, environmental education, and overall advocacy for water quality.
How are you solving the issue of plastic in your own personal waste stream?
I'm not. I'm like I said, I'm doing 12 to 18 hours, 7 days a week. I've been doing it for almost 20 years, and I'm putting my effort into what I said of water quality protection, primarily coastal creeks, and providing alive biology programs in public schools.
That's great. Thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of Gaia and also for everyone.
And I just want to let your listeners know that the information that you just gave me about, you answered my question, which, by the way, I'm attributing to a number of good health practices, but particularly red yeast rice as opposed to big pharma statins.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to let listeners know that we are getting information that would cost us hundreds, at least $100 to $150 if we went and made an appointment with a qualified doctor here in Santa Cruz County.
And it's all free, and all you have to do is call 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877.
Yes, ma'am. Robert,
before you go, I have one little free tidbit for you.
Okay.
Because you're taking the red rice yeast, I do recommend that you get an annual set of liver function tests at a minimum. Because there is, at least in terms of what the molecule is that's lowering your cholesterol, there is some chance of irritating the liver. And so I do recommend monitoring twice a year for statins, and if you're on red rice yeast, at least once a year. There's a test called an ALT, which is alanine something or other transferase, and that's the marker that we typically use to look for inflammation of the liver.
Well, Dr. Don, I'm looking at a page, and I see ALT, and
good.
The score is 22.
Then you're in business. You're doing great.
Sweet Jesus. Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Bye-bye, Robert. Right. Let's go to Tony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
We met at one of your health affairs at the local elementary school.
Oh, hi.
Hi. First of all, before I forget, as I was listening after calling, is it a BPA or BTA? I am hearing both of them.
Oh, that's just my bad pronunciation.
No,
it's bisphonyl, P-H-O-N, so it's P.
Gotcha, okay. Well, the reason I called is I thought your talk about older people being at risk for a reoccurrence of the zoster problem, I guess, which is herpes as well, because it stays in your body, and as your immune system deteriorates, you're subject to reinfection with that sort of thing. But there's two other major diseases, which I'm 75 years old, and I'm aware of the fact that polio can come back and tuberculosis can come back because they're those viruses or bugs, whatever they are sealed up in little capsules, and they'll come out if your immune system deteriorates. So,
well, not true of polio.
Oh, really?
No. What's happening in polio when you're older is a little bit different. We can talk about that, but
well,
I want you to make your point.
All I'm saying is that my point is that the immune system is probably the most important thing for you to consider as you get into old age.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because the immune system also is what protects us from cancer.
I see.
And so part of the reason we see more cancers as we get older is that there has been more time to accumulate point mutations, and that certainly is a factor. But the other piece is that your immune system has less ability to fight off a challenge. So we're more likely that what cancers do arise are more likely to have a chance to get a foothold.
Well, cancers and zoster are certainly important, but you've really piqued my interest because I have friends who had polio and are worried about, in fact, I worried for them.
Yes.
Because I'd heard this, maybe it's misinformation, but polio is not really a factor in old age.
What happens in polio is the disease itself attacks the cells that are the motor neurons, the long motor neurons in your spinal column. That's where the disease hits. And temporarily you get a paralysis. And as people recovered back in the days when we saw a lot of polio, they would regain partial or full use of their limbs.
Right.
But they were doing that on many fewer wires, essentially. They'd lost a bunch of their cabling.
Uh-huh.
And as you get into your sixth and seventh and eighth decades,
right,
then those cables that have been running all the traffic to your legs,
they wear out, huh?
have worn out. And you don't have any backup cables because those have been damaged. So you've been running essentially on what you have left. And as that starts to erode, you become weaker. That's called post-polio syndrome.
Right.
And it's not the virus itself, thank God.
I congratulate you on your ability to make it as technical as you do, because I'm a civil engineer and it really means a lot for me to hear technical explanations. And now I can pass that on to some of my friends.
Yeah, I have always felt that one of the things that is very important, and it's partly the genesis of this program, is if people can understand things in terms of, you know, something they get, like cables and wires,
right,
and, you know, then it makes sense. And the
plumbing.
And the meme, that is
right,
to say the core of the idea, sticks with you. And you're able to, because you have that associational pathway, you're able to understand the importance of a particular thing with respect to your own self-interest.
Perhaps you'll remember better who I am when I tell you you're both erudite and erudite. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Before we go to our next caller, I got to throw this out because it was in the New York Times reprints and I just really enjoyed it. We've talked before and I would refer you to interviews with I think it was Margaret Nestle, N-E-S-T-L-E, and we'll check that first name, but they're in the archives at Ask Dr. Don, and she worked for the FDA for a long time and also the Department of Agriculture and knows all about the nutrition politics. And this story was something that went on during the Bush administration, but the United States Department of Agriculture essentially was chasing its own tail. It had one entity that was trying to reduce obesity in the United States. So it was recommending, you know, appropriate portions, reduce saturated fat, all the sort of good nutrition advice you should expect to have from the U.S. Department of Agriculture or whoever is helping you out with the food pyramid. And then at the same time, they had a organization that was subunit of the Agriculture Department called Dairy Management that was pushing cheese down our throats, doing all kinds of promoting things, free advertising for Domino's Pizza, for example, getting them to use more cheese, all sorts of informational releases being sent out that dairy and dairy calcium helps lower your weight. It helps improve weight loss, which, by the way, was based on one study which failed to replicate. And the study failed to replicate during the time that they were promoting it as dairy helps you lose weight. Not true, not reestablished. But again, you say anything often enough, liberals are bad, feminism is bad. You say that often enough and suddenly it becomes true and no one wants to be called a liberal or a feminist anymore. It was Marion Nestle, by the way, and it's July 25th, 2009. interesting food politics primer. I would recommend it to you if you have an interest in this topic. Anyway, let's go to our next caller, and that is Debbie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Debbie, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I've had problems with osteoporosis. It's hereditary in my family. I recently had sent in a blood sample to a company called Genovations, and they gave me a profile that gave me the genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms associated with increased risk of developing osteopenia and osteoporosis.
Right.
There's five of these markers. The one that I have a double positive on is the CalCR. And the recommendation here, it says the calcitronin receptor mediates the cellular action of the hormone calcitronin. And it acts to decrease serum calcium levels. And what they recommend here, aside from all the lifestyle changes that I've already done, I do all the weight-bearing activity, all the right diet, all these supplements, blah, 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 is salmon, calcitronin, and human recombinant calcitronin are available as nasal spray and have been shown to be roughly as effective as estrogen replacement therapy in postmenopausal women. The effects of both calcitronin and estrogen therapy are dramatically enhanced threefold with calcium supplementation. I'll let you do that. So my question to you is, how and where do I get calcitronin, salmon calcitronin? This I've never seen or heard of this.
Well, that's because that particular company doesn't do direct-to-consumer advertising for this product. So you might have seen ads for Fosamax, but you won't, which you won't see anymore because that's gone generic. But do not assume that what you see on television is the whole, you know, I know you don't, but I'm just saying what's advertised is really what they think they can build a market for. It has nothing to do with what actually exists for a given condition. I find this extremely interesting, and I will look into this particular laboratory and its testing, because I can see that as being very useful for people who have, let's say they're at 50, they're perimenopausal, they're wondering what they should do. They get a bone scan, and the bone scan says, well, you know, your bones are a little thin, but we don't know if you never reached your full bone density or if you actually are prone to osteopenia, and we really can't say. And so if a person carried this genetic mutation, which basically makes that receptor not respond as well to a given dose of hormone. So,
right.
So that's what it means, is that you need bigger doses of hormone to kick the receptor into action. I doubt very seriously that any research has ever been done where they took the subgroup of the population that has this poorly functioning receptor and then gave them calcitonin versus placebo and measured over 5 or 10 years the deterioration of their bones. I doubt that's been done because it would be technically very difficult and very expensive, and the only person who would conceivably pay for it would be the government, which in the last 25 years hasn't paid for stuff like this, certainly in the last 10 years. But that would be really interesting. I'm trying to remember the name of the commercial name of the drug, but it doesn't matter. Salmon calcitonin is available as a nasal spray. Mm-hmm. I actually prescribe it to people who have pain after an osteoporotic fracture because it really works for pain. It seems to help, let's say, bandage the bone that's collapsed in the spine, and people get pain relief. So I always try it for them. There was an argument about 15 years ago about which was the most effective drugs. And when you looked at salmon calcitonin in the general population, and then you followed them for a couple of years and you looked for fracture rates, you did not see an improvement in fracture rate. And so it kind of got dropped out of first-line therapy for osteoporosis. But I'm betting that it's a subgroup of the population who has this mutation that would really benefit from this product.
Exactly. Yeah, because there are five different markers here. Not everybody's going to have the same marker that causes osteoporosis.
Yes, and the hormone, the hormone, by the way, is calcitonin.
Oh, calcitonin, okay, yeah.
But yes, it is absolutely something that one could theoretically support. The mechanism makes sense for you. I think the data for efficacy is lacking, but I'll suggest a kind of way that you might be able to assess the efficacy in your case, and that would be to look at urine bone breakdown markers. There are multiple different ones of these. The one that's offered locally by the local lab that everybody uses is N-telopeptide, T-E-L-O. And that can be measured in your urine, and it's something that is higher when you're losing bone and lower when you're building bone.
Right.
So if you get a baseline level and then do Salmon calcitonin for a couple of months, mm-hmm. and then while using it, get a second blood level, or mm-hmm. excuse me, a second urine level.
Sure.
And you show from the comparison of those two data points that you have a decrease in the telopeptide levels, that would indicate that your bone metabolism has gone from negative to positive.
Yeah, that it's working for me.
Yes. And so you'd be able to validate it, which I think would be important for two reasons, one of which is cost.
Right, exactly.
And the idea that you are paying for it out of pocket initially, you definitely want to be sure it's working for you. And secondly, if you do have health insurance that covers drugs and you developed this and wrote, and your doctor sat down and wrote a letter, you would absolutely get it through an appeals committee in terms of getting it paid for.
Mm-hmm.
So they initially might say, oh, well, it's not indicated. But then if you could demonstrate these sorts of changes, it would absolutely go through the appeals committee.
Great. Well, you are my doctor, and I will be calling for a prescription.
All right. Fair enough. I would like to see the report.
Yes.
And I'll be talking to you soon. Remind me that we spoke on the radio, though, okay?
Sure will.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Rod in San Francisco. Hello, Rod, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
Roughly when I was in my early 20s, which is close to 50 years ago now, I was diagnosed with having food allergies and I was placed on an elimination diet, and that led to the diagnosis. And I was quite allergic to many of the foods that were on the initial diet and ended up being on a very restricted diet for quite a few years just because I got tired of trying to expand my diet and feeling sickly. And had some scratch tests, which would be primarily, I guess, for
IgE.
IgEs, right. Mm-hmm. That was some years later, probably 5 years later. And the only things I registered being very allergic to were the things that I had splurged on for holidays and things like this. So I've tried to expand my diet periodically and never very successfully, I should say. A couple years ago now, I had some IgG tests, and they shocked me by showing that I had high antibody levels to things that I routinely eat and didn't do anything because I didn't know what else to eat.
Right.
So I'm trying to do this again, but maybe on a little wiser basis, that it's been suggested to me that my problem is not really with the immune system, but rather with leaky gut.
Good.
And I'd like you to point me in directions where perhaps I should head at this point.
All right. Let me start by saying that we are out of conventional medicine at this point, and we are into a space that I will call the alternative medicine / research medicine space, in that there is data to support everything I'm going to be saying. But conventional medicine, what they teach in medical school, does not recognize these concepts. Researchers in medicine would talk about these concepts in a learned way and say, yes, this hypothesis is supported by the following evidence. But I need to say all of that before we talk, because it really is that gray zone when we talk about these things. Let's use the word food sensitivity to describe a reaction that does not involve hives, wheezing, vascular collapse as a manifestation of the symptoms. So you don't wheeze, you don't get a low blood pressure, you don't develop hives. It's not like what happens when you get a bee sting and you're allergic to bee stings. That's an IgE response, like the kids with the peanuts, and they breathe peanuts in the lunchroom and they start wheezing. It's a different kind of reaction, and that's what allergists concern themselves with. We aren't talking about that. We're talking about something different. Scratch tests only deal with that issue, that kind of allergy.
Yeah, I do get immediate responses also.
Yeah, but for the purpose of the discussion, we're going to confine it to this other gray zone. It's a very important distinction, because the antibody type that we're concerned about here is IgG, capital G. G as in George, not E as in Edward. Now, IgG floats around in the bloodstream. It's not carried in mast cells in the skin. And its job is to coat anything like a bacterium or a virus that it's trained against and coat it so that it's like flagged for the immune system to eat and get rid of the part of the immune system called the reticuloendothelial system, which is basically your spleen and your lymph nodes and your polymorphal nuclear cells, which are one type of white cell. And they're big amoebas, and they eat these particles that have been coated with IgG, or opsonized is the other term for it. So essentially, this is a disposal system, like a big trash system, that flags things for disposal, then grabs them, chomps them up, engulfs them, and digests them. And in the process of doing that, waste products and inflammation is created. Also, these opsonized particles are larger, and they tend to be filtered out. So they will go to the lymph nodes, they will go to the spleen, they will go to the intestinal lymph nodes, of which there are many millions, and they will also tend to deposit in joints and in the skin, because those are capillary, large capillary systems that have a lot of capacity to just filter out these particles. So the reactions, if you have, let's say you consume a food that contains a compound X, and this compound is a protein sugar, and this protein sugar is broken down completely by your digestive system, and your digestive tract has a good barrier functioning. So you break it down, it goes right through you, you poop it out, it never gets into the bloodstream so that the IgG can react to it. That's the best case scenario. Now, let's suppose you don't have great barrier functioning and you've got good enzyme functioning. So you break down most of these molecules, but you don't break down all of them. And the ones you don't break down have a chance to diffuse across a poor intestinal barrier. That's the leaky gut. And once they're into the bloodstream and the lymph fluid, then the IgG can grab them and you get your reaction of not feeling well. Kind of like you're coming down with something. Maybe you get a yucky feeling belly. Maybe you get sniffles. Maybe your joints ache. Maybe you get a rash. These are all possible reactions of this same sort of intolerance we're talking about. Oral ulcerations, another one. So there's a couple of things that need to be addressed. If that's your situation, which it sounds like it is, and you stop eating the foods that you have antibody to, and you start eating other foods over time, because you have the leaky intestine, well, you'll develop new sensitivities and you'll become sensitive to the things that you're consuming in the largest quantities, which is manifestly what happened to you. And I see a lot of self-induced elimination dietitis, I call it, which is where a person finds that they feel better on a restricted diet and it works for a while, but then they end up restricting further and further as they developed more sensitivity. And the problem is the key thing of intestinal permeability isn't addressed. That hasn't been fixed. So my advice to you is you're going to need to find yourself a functional medicine practitioner. That could be a naturopath, that could be someone who's a member of the IFM, who's gone through their program, who's a graduate of that, because you learn how to treat this there. There are a lot of people who have learned on their own through books, but you know, if you want a clearinghouse, I would go to functionalmedicine.org and go with someone who has taken their course, because they'll have the basics. But it involves making sure you don't have the wrong bacteria or the wrong yeast or parasites growing in your intestine, because those are going to mess up your barrier functioning and you won't be able to repair it. It involves feeding your intestine certain compounds that allow it to reformulate its barrier. It involves therapeutic use of certain amino acids and certain nutrients, and it's way beyond the scope of a reply over a telephone. This is an ongoing conversation, and it takes hours of multiple office visits to really reverse this kind of a situation. But it's a valuable thing to do in individuals who have this problem. So, you know, you could come down and see me, you could go to IFM and find someone up in San Francisco, but you really do need more professional help than you're going to be able to get off of the web.
Yes, I think that's true.
All right.
I will do this.
All right.
So thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before we go to our next caller, I wanted to respond to a couple of emails. I had them on my priority list, but I wanted to get back to Tom in St. Louis, thyroid issues. And Tom was misinformed by his primary care person, and I want to take care of that before he goes off on the wrong trip here. 2 years ago, my TSH was 7. A year later, it was 3.5. Now it's back to 6.5. I'm not overweight. Eat right and exercise. I read an article that says if you are athletic and eating a low sodium, you might be iodine deficient, and that could cause a high TSH. The doctor's assistant called back and said, take 150 micrograms of iodine. And then he also adds he has a low body temperature and his hands get cold whenever the temperature's below 55. So, Tom, it's very possible that you may have some subclinical hypothyroidism with a TSH at 7 and then 3.5. That makes me think that you might have an autoimmune problem as well. So I would recommend getting tested for thyroid peroxidase antibody, which is abbreviated TPO, and also antimicrosomal antibody. And if either of those are positive, then I would further get tested for the tissue transglutaminase IgG antibody and something called deaminated gliadin antibody. And those are gluten sensitivity markers. And gluten has a molecule that people develop an antibody to that is like the thyroid. And so it'll tend to trigger an autoimmune attack on the thyroid, which might make your thyroid sluggish and thus make your pituitary send this strong high signal. So if it's gone up and down twice, that's not just viral. That could be autoimmune. That should be investigated. When I see this situation, I will often check for iodine deficiency, or I'll just empirically treat people if that's too nuanced to go into the differences. There are a couple of alternative medicine things like giving people iodine paint, painting it on their skin and seeing how long it stays there. Those have not been sufficiently validated in a real scientific format for me to feel like those are decent tests. So I use other methods. But if I'm going to supplement iodine, or I think someone might be deficient, I will usually have them use about 3 milligrams a day, working up gradually to that dose, not just jumping in immediately. If you have a lot of accumulated fluoride or chlorine or bromine, which is in bread now, and a lot of people have high bromine occupying their iodine receptors in their body. And so if you give them iodine, you kick off a bunch of bromine, which has a lower affinity, so the iodine kicks it off. But suddenly you've got a ton of bromine in your bloodstream and you get a metallic taste in your mouth and feel yucky. So I usually have people creep up on the iodine, but there's nothing wrong with doses of 3 to 5 milligrams. The 150 microgram that you were recommended is the minimum amount required to prevent a goiter, which is just nuts, okay? If somebody's deficient, you don't give them the minimum amount required to prevent a goiter. You give them a repletion dose. If somebody comes in and they're B12 deficient, we don't give them the minimum daily requirement of B12. We give them big shots, large amounts of B12 to get their body back up to sufficiency. So this is just kind of nuts. And there's this huge anti-iodine, completely unscientifically validated bias. The current generation of doctors was taught in medical school that if you give iodine to people, they're going to have a thyroid crisis, which is just not true, demonstrably not true. But it's like in the medical textbooks, there's no actual data that supports it. But hey, it's in the textbook, so it must be true, right? Well, wait till the next version of the textbook. Let's go to Larry in Atlanta. Hello, Larry, is that you?
Dr. Dawn, it is. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Thank you so much. I'll be brief. I'm calling to get your opinion on the cause of my mom's death. Very briefly, recently my mom passed, and it happened in San Francisco. The background is she went to San Francisco with a couple of girlfriends to travel the wine country. She hurt her ankle. Thinking smart, right, she went to a local hospital, got some pain medication, had a cast. Wasn't feeling well, went to a hotel. A few days after that, she passed. Just the other day, I finally got the copy from the San Francisco Medical Examiner's office, and I have to say, everyone there, in my opinion, walks on water. I mean, they are just so wonderful.
I'm sure they'll be glad to hear that.
I said 1,000 times, honest to God, really.
Yeah, if they can walk on water, then they can, you know, get across the bay without having to get on that bridge, which they would all love.
All I can say is from your mouth to God's ears, as the saying goes.
Well, what did it say?
Well, I can say, too, is the doctor that actually did the autopsy also said that the cause of her death was very unusual. What they said was, quote, cause of death, probable aspiration pneumonia due to complications of left ankle sprain, other conditions, chronic renal disease, history of hypertension, history of asthma. Some additional background on my mom. My mom, I believe, had high blood pressure. She had dentures. The doctor told me that she had, hopefully I'm saying this right, oxycodone, something like that, in the urine, not in her blood. I said, medical examiner, I said, if mom had not had her ankle accident, would this have happened?
Mm-hmm.
The answer was, it would not have happened if she didn't have that accident.
Okay, so let me just throw out that I'd love to read the report, but hypothetically, what may have happened was that she hurt herself, so she needed pain meds. So she got pain meds, and being an old lady with poor detoxification, in other words, she has some renal insufficiency, she's probably got a little heart failure, so she's not sending blood through her liver, which is the other major detoxifier. So she gets a high blood level of her pain med, and because the blood level is high enough, it maybe affects her gag reflex. So now at night when you're asleep, you've got, you know, phlegm and you've got the stomach contents, particularly the stomach contents, you'll, you know, belch up a little bit in your sleep and that stomach content is now in your throat. You could breathe it in. And under normal circumstances, you have a gag reflex that prevents that from breathing in anything from your stomach contents. It keeps it out of your lungs. But if the gag reflex is suppressed by the pain med, which, by the way, it does numb up that gag reflex and the cough reflex too. That's why we use it as cough syrup. So, you know, we've given her effectively something that helped her pain, but the price was that she can't protect her airway. So she sucks in the stomach contents, and the stomach contents, that's what aspiration pneumonia is. And the pneumonia goes to the lowest part of the lung, which is on the right side. And of course, it can become a massive infection. So it could have been, you know, the ankle, kind of like one of those, this is the, you know, horse that tripped and fell, that, you know, hit the head, blah, blah, blah. So this is one of those events where you get a chain of circumstances that lead to a bad outcome. If she'd gotten other pain medicines, like if, let's suppose they gave her ibuprofen and she got a stomach ulcer and then had GI bleed, and that's what led to her death. But ultimately, if she hadn't gotten the ibuprofen, she would have gotten a codeine type drug, and that would have led to her aspiration pneumonia. So it may have just been her time. You know, I'm a great believer in the fact that sometimes it's just time.
Is something like this just a bizarre situation, you know, from your experience?
Yes. And I mean, I haven't read the report, but
right.
I want to caution you against looking for someone to blame. Somebody did something wrong and therefore, you know, that killed my mom. Your mom was old. She had multiple health problems and a chain of events occurred, but I don't think anybody, I mean, would be, number one, against the law, number two, unethical, not to treat pain. And
sure.
So, you know, we've got this whole thing about doctors being afraid to give pain meds because, you know, they get blamed, for example, for a situation like this. So, and so as a result, for one person who might have died, 999 suffer because they couldn't get pain meds because the doctor's afraid of the 1 in 1,000 event. You know, you don't want to set that up either. And like I said, I think you have to understand that it could have been anything. I mean, she might have aspirated anyway, just for people do. I mean, aspiration pneumonia is probably the most common cause of nursing home death because eventually, you know, those poor people in the nursing homes who they have bad dementia and they're in bed all the time and there's nothing we can do to fix that. But then they also don't have good airway protection and so they get pneumonia all the time. And sometimes you're at the situation where they're so bad off, you look at the family and say, you know, I don't have to give antibiotics for this pneumonia. We can just let it take grandma, or we can fight it off, and then 6 months from now, we'll be doing it again. That's one of those situations that I've seen enough clinically to know that aspiration pneumonia can happen all by itself. So eventually, that might have been how she was going to die. And
Dr. Dawn, as always, you're wonderful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for the call. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Marion in Carmel.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
I'm calling about gout. I'm 75 in 2 months. And when I was 19, I was diagnosed as gout, quite severe. My father was picking me up and carrying me to doctors that were giving me huge shots of cortisone. And finally, after the third shot, I said, what kind of arthritis do I have? And the doctor said, I don't know. And I thought, uh-oh. and I called a girlfriend who I knew had arthritis. And she sent me to her doctor. And I was quite surprised to find that I had gout at 19. I just had a baby. And he said my metabolism was way off, and my thyroid, and I did have gout, and started treatment of cortisone and diet. And it took about a year because I was crippled with my feet, hips, and hands.
I'm looking for the question in what you've said,
okay,
and I haven't heard it.
I've got gout again.
Mm-hmm.
I've had little flares, but I'm confused. I've had a lab test. I know I have the uric poisoning.
So did your lab test show a high uric acid in your bloodstream?
Yes.
Okay. So and that, yes.
And it went high glucose and high blood urea, nitrogen, and high for creatine.
Okay.
All those three,
but also high uric acid?
Yes.
Okay. Because blood urea nitrogen, or BUN, is different from uric acid. People confuse them sometimes.
I know. Okay. They're both listed out separately.
So what it means is that you have some problems with your kidneys, and if you have a high blood sugar, you may have diabetes, which can cause kidney problems.
Yes.
And diabetics are more likely to have gout. And so the whole thing is, really, it's not three diseases. It's one disease where they contribute to each other, if you can reframe it that way. There are certain foods which aggravate gout, particularly organ meats, and so sausages or any kind of meat that has chopped up organ meats in it, so hamburger even sometimes if they use intestinal meats, but particularly sausages, frankfurters, things like that, can have enough to create a problem with the gout. Your body doesn't break down a certain kind of protein called a purine, and so you develop high levels of the intermediate breakdown product in your bloodstream. There are drugs that you can take that help in one of two ways. You can take agents that improve the kidneys getting rid of uric acid, and there are several of those, including Indocin, which is indomethacin. It's actually used for acute gout. So one way, so that can be helpful. Your doctor has to be careful, though, because indomethacin can aggravate the problems with the kidney. And so it's a real tightrope to get the dosing right and to make sure you don't hurt the patient.
Okay. I have an endocrinologist. I'll be seeing her next week. My thyroid was removed.
Okay. So
perfect.
So anyway, in a case of acute gout, the first step is pain control. Because you're complicated, you know, I would, in uncomplicated gout, you can just give prednisone.
And I'm on Coumadin.
But you can't have prednisone because you're diabetic and it'll make your diabetes much worse. So using something that controls the pain, like maybe the hydrocodone that the guy from Atlanta was talking about that his mother got, maybe that would be safe for you at a low dose, or at least the risk-benefit ratio would work for that for pain control. And then you have to get rid of the acute attack by dropping the uric acid. And then in the long run, you might want to use an agent that reduces your formation of uric acid. And there's a compound called allopurinol that I would consider giving to someone in your clinical situation that would reduce the chance that you would have another gout attack. But you can't use that during an acute gout attack. It's not safe under that circumstance.
Oh, so once the gout is under control, then?
Right. Then you use allopurinol to continue remission. And for people with high uric acid in the blood, that's a very effective therapy.
Okay.
So your clinical situation is very complicated, and you really need to be working closely with your endocrinologist. And they
help me, really?
Yes. Yes. And if they are not willing to take on gout, they're too focused on diabetes, then you should see a nephrologist, N-E-P-H, nephrologist, if you need to help you get on the right treatment for this. Because we don't want you in pain. We don't want anybody suffering. And this is a horrible, horrible disease. It's very painful. I know you know that.
Yes, I asked my doctor to send me to physical therapy for my heel.
Yeah, well, that's a different thing. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I hope I've helped a little bit.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope you'll be back next week. This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.